The organizers, and I am at least at the titular level one of the organizers, felt that rather than having a extended series of theory talks on some of these topics, we could sort of focus things a little bit more by having a what we called a panel discussion. I'm not sure if we knew exactly what we meant when we said panel discussion. The original version of the panel discussion, as formulated by Jason, was quite draconian. You weren't allowed to even open your mouth unless you addressed one of the 17 canonical questions which we sent around in the email. The theorists, who don't take kindly to being told what to do under any circumstances, rose up in arms and said, you know, if we're not allowed to say everything we want to say about any possible topic, we won't even come. And in the end, we came up with some sort of compromise, which is they have to address the draconian questions unless they really, really want to address some other question. And so we'll see how that turns out. But there is, Jason has actually covered a lot of the sort of potential questions that we thought were particularly interesting, in which there was a lot of controversy. We're going to be hearing in this portion of the panel section from Alan and from Kathy. And I'm going to give them each about 15 minutes to sort of lay out their general case, and after each one we'll have about 5 or 10 minutes of conversation, maybe a wrap-up conversation. I'm really going to ask these two speakers to panel. They're not even speakers, they're panel discussion members, but somehow they've evolved into speakers. I'm not sure how this happened, but to keep their remarks towards 15 minus, not 15 plus. And towards that end, Sandy is giving me the all-important yellow flag here, which think of this more as a yellow card. And then we have the red card, and we know what that means. Okay, Alan, go ahead.
I need a projector. I'm criticizing the organizers because what happened when a lot of the particular theorists got these questions from Jason and others as to what we're supposed to answer, they all left the ship. They refused to come on because they said the questions were too difficult. But also, as far as I know, a panel is supposed to have a table, and we're supposed to be sitting on that table.
Alan,
but I'm sure by tomorrow these things will be organized.
Time you spent criticizing the organization is subtracted from your talk on both ends.
Well, anyway, I made some rough comments here. Let me just quickly say that 6 years ago there was a BEC, a cold atom. In those days it was BEC. Can you hear me in the back? Yeah. Is it on or? Yeah.
It closed over here.
Oh, over here. Is that? You're in the front though. There in the back. But anyway, about I think 6 years ago there was the first cold atom workshop here at that time ITP, and several people, some of the organizers, in fact, Sandy, I think was you were there, yeah, and. Tony Leggett was the director, and I remember just towards the end when he was leaving for some other event, he had lunch with several of us older people, senior people, and we thought it was nice having a lunch, but of course Tony always has an ulterior motive for these lunches, and at the end he said, okay, let's get down to it. This is 1998. What's really basically new in this subject? What's the real contribution we expect to make or have already made? So various people in the audience, like myself, I think Peter Zoller, I mean, around this lunch and several others, made our suggestions. I think Peter, who had just come up with his Bose-Hubbard optical lattice model, thought optical lattices might be a good thing, and Tony said, no, we know about lattices. And I came up with various things. This is even before Feshbach resonance says, no. So Tony, it was sort of a depressing lunch. And then Tony left because he says, well, basically, it's nothing really new here that we really do something. Well, I think, Tony, of course, always disagrees with me, but I think this whole business of Feshbach resonances and the BCS-BEC crossover in connection with Feshbach resonances is really new. And in fact, if I could go back 6 years, now I'll tell Tony that's what's really new. In the sense, it's something the condensed matter theorists, the nuclear theorists, the theoretical community had just simply not considered. And we're all grappling with it, maybe somewhat unsuccessfully. But at least it's really some new physics here, some new challenges, some new ideas and what have you, and we're in the process of doing that. And I think since it's certainly, I think, conceptually the most exciting development since the discovery development certainly since 1995 when BEC was discovered. I'm going to make my remarks here also, I should emphasize, from the background of a condensed matter theorist, and in particular one who in my previous life worked on superconductivity, and this topic therefore is very natural for me, but I'll also make some comments that I think condensed matter people would say about the current discussion. Let me just introduce the model that, which goes back to, of course, has a long history in condensed matter physics, but Murray Holland and Timmermans were the first ones in 2001 to emphasize this might be relevant to deal with the Festbrock resonances. And just remind you, you have this coupling term, which I call GR, and then you have the two Fermi gases spin up and spin down with total energy 2E epsilon F, and my notation epsilon Q0 is the center of mass motion of the molecule, and 2 nu is the threshold energy, but it's also the detuning, or also 2 nu is proportional to B minus B0 and stuff like that. You're all familiar with this. In any event, I might say just a comment here that this was referred many times by Jason, and of course in the recent literature, as the two-channel model, because we're introducing artificially molecules, okay? But of course, in my opinion, I think most theorists would agree that of course a single-channel calculation has to be correct. Namely, you put in two types of fermions, and there's some interaction between those fermions, and everything has to come out of that thing. That's it. A single, in that sense, the work of Strunati and his co-workers in Italy is, in my opinion, there's no question, is the best approach, and I don't think you can argue about that. Of course, it's very complicated. The reason that people introduce this is to short-circuit some of the physics, as we often do in physics, to get at the real physics, but ultimately this has to agree with more fundamental study of simply putting in two Fermi gases which are interacting. Everything, including molecules, including human beings, has to come out of that problem, right? The point is, it's complicated. So there's the real complicated single-channel problem, and then there's the approximate baby single-channel problem. So when we're arguing about two-channel versus one-channel, we're arguing about, is a simple one-channel problem with, you know, just one parameter versus the two-channel, and again, simplified, how are those both are approximations to the correct question, which is the problem of a two-component Fermi gas which is interacting with some given interatomic potential. Well, anyway, the theory I'm going to just make some comments on is based on that Hamiltonian for the superfluid phase, Bose-condensed phase, and I'm only going to discuss the very baby approach, namely mean field approximation. Kathy might discuss some improvements on that. The mean field approximation, of course, is valid at t equals zero and goes back to Leggett and Eagles and what have you in the 1980s. Of course, this mean field theory can be improved by including fluctuations, such fancy name for the thermal cloud of molecules. And of course, particularly to get TC properly, you have to include those fluctuations, i.e. you have to remember that the BCS theory at T equals zero, and also in superconductors, the whole idea of TC, which is always an important question to ask, where do things disappear, will occur when you break up a Cooper pair. But of course we know, and it goes back to Schmidt, Rink, and Nozière in the middle 80s, that in fact in this system we make contact with Einstein rather than BCS. Namely, what happens is the TC is not due to the fact we break up a Cooper pair, but we simply excite the Cooper pairs from, in some sense, the condensate into finite momentum states. That is, we produce a thermal cloud of molecules, and eventually, as Einstein pointed out, there's a maximum, you know, there's a TC that comes from that. But that's, in other words, mean field is very good at T equals zero, but we know how to include fluctuations, that is depletion, by getting molecules out of those states And that's the theory of TC. In any event, one of the things you get in this type of theory, of course, in the mean field theory, is a condensate parameter related to the molecules, phi m, which is simply the expectation value of B, the B operator, and a wave function describing the Cooper pairs, the AA type term. Okay. What's interesting, of course, because these two quantities are strongly hybridized, one is exactly given in terms of the other, where 2 nu here is my binding energy of my molecule, and 2 mu is the chemical potential of the bosons. And therefore, it ends up in this type of theory at the mean field level, which should be very good at T equals zero, that you essentially end up with a BCS theory, where now the only thing that Feshbach resonance leads to is a delta tilde in Randeria and Leggett and what have you. A long time ago, you just had this term that is the usual attractive interaction. U here being positive means attraction, times the Cooper pair, the expectation value of AA. And the new thing about the Feshbach resonance, this formation of the molecules now, is you get an extra term in here. But it turns out, because of this relation, you can rewrite this in terms of, if you want, just Cooper pairs in terms of an effective attraction given by that. Where this is simply, of course, the equivalent of the induced attractive interaction due to the fact that fermions can excite and absorb boson modes, and these boson modes are called molecules. Yeah. Okay. Now, out of this theory, very quickly, comes the following sort of thing from PRL by Yoji Ohashi and myself in 2002. And I want to just discuss it in a little bit of detail, because I hate to say, but a lot of people refer to this paper, but my impression is no one ever reads it, which is well known amongst theorists. So I'm going to take you through it. Okay, this is actually for the uniform gas, but we've done equivalent calculations for the trapped gas. So this should not be used to compare with experiments in trapped gases, but as I'll mention. But in any event, we've already seen here, this is TC, the BCS, and as you, 2 nu over 2 epsilon F goes through zero here, you go from the BCS curve over the BEC and the famous 2.218. I emphasize the same sort of thing for a trap gas, is that this whole curve goes up to 0.528. In any event, what I want to talk about, and these results here are TC, but we've done calculations below TC, and you get the same sort of behavior. And it's very interesting physically, since this is what we're dealing with in these experiments, to actually go through these various curves. Okay? Now, the fact that theorists can calculate things doesn't necessarily mean experimentalists can measure them. Because in my opinion, a Cooper pair is a molecule. A molecule is a Cooper pair. There's no distinction. No distinction. Okay? Theoretically, of course, we can talk about calculate the contributions, but experimentally, you're looking for two animals, and there's only one animal out in the field. Okay. Okay. Now, for instance, the main thing is, as we've heard many times, is that this type of theory gives a sort of uniform, sort of smooth behavior as you go through the atomic two-body resonance here at zero. Okay. Where, of course, this is the BEC region and the BCS region. Now, when you actually do, in the theory, calculate the number of fermions, of course, the total number of atoms is fixed, the number of free fermions goes down. You have this curve here, okay? What happens in the so-called BCS region, which is a useful term, but shouldn't be thought of as something different than the BEC region, they're the same things. A molecular Bose condensate, it's just as interesting, just as great as the BCS thing that people seem to feel obligated to find. In any event, you have this curve here, which is the number of bosons, these two-body type molecules, but now renormalized by the fact that they're in a many-body system. They already start to occur. For instance, when 2 nu over 2 epsilon F is about 1. And that just comes from the fact that's when suddenly the molecule can actually, has got roughly the same energy as, you know, it can actually be formed by two fermions. Hank Stoof and Falco put great emphasis on this. But the thing is, you can see that basically you don't have very many molecules, as you'd expect. until you get 2 nu over 2 epsilon f is of order 1. Then it starts to build up. But these molecules here, this dot dash line here, are molecules of finite lifetime. Their lifetime gets bigger and bigger, longer and longer, the closer you get here, okay? You also, in this region here, even though I haven't shown it, you also get damped Cooper. So these are damped molecules. You also have damped Cooper pairs. That is, Cooper pairs which are resonant states. It's simply because, of course, in this case of nu being positive, that the state you're dealing with, the bound state, is above the vacuum. And it's got a finite lifetime, but the lifetimes are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Okay. This is important. I don't have a Nobel Prize for it. But in any event, the thing is, what happens at this point at a renormalized value? Why does this not occur at zero? At this point, the molecules have an infinite lifetime. They suddenly have an infinite lifetime. They cannot decay. Once they can't, it occurs at a value, positive value of nu, simply because of many body effects. Now, the interesting point is, also the Cooper pairs become infinitely long-lived there. The Cooper pairs now, with this dotted line, exist in the so-called BEC region. And of course, in the single channel problem of Randeria, the only thing you would have Cooper pairs, and the Cooper pairs would form the bosons. But in this case, the molecule, the B molecules, win out. And while these number of stable Cooper pairs exist, they lose out as you go further and further away from the threshold. But in this resonance region, on the BEC side, you've got Cooper pairs and molecules. On the BCS side, you've got finite lifetime molecules and finite lifetime Cooper pairs. And it's a smooth transition in between. Then you could say, okay, how do we actually measure these two types of things? You can't, because they're so strongly hybridized. They're so strongly hybridized that they're the same object, basically. Finally, the last thing I want to emphasize is that one of the things the experimentalists should do and have not, I think because they come from BEC, is it's what's really exciting about these systems is the fact you've got unpaired atoms. The unpaired atoms contain a huge amount of information. So at this point here, it might be, for these particular numbers, you've got a certain number of unpaired atoms, this black line. Now, for instance, in kinetic matter physics, almost all our knowledge of and belief that BCS theory works very well for things like aluminum and what have you, is due to the study of the quasiparticles, the so-called remaining electrons. Cooper pairs are almost never studied in superconductivity directly, or very seldomly. You mainly study them by studying the quasiparticles. So in my opinion, the best, one of the most promising new experimental techniques, which I think we need in this field, because ramps and sudden changes to the system, to a kinetic matter physicist, I just tremble. I tremble, okay? Because you're modifying the system by doing all that. But the quasiparticles, as well as the collective modes, by the way, for those of you who study them, I think are a great way too. Anything that doesn't involve a ramp, a jump, a push, you know? But the quasiparticles should be very nice because they always will be BCS-like, and they will give direct measure on the order parameter. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Can we have some discussion with respect to Alan's point?
Is the many body shift that is contained in your approach in contradiction with the universality argument discussed by Jason?
I'm not sure about that. In fact, I would have asked Jason a question. He was mentioning, for instance, this value of beta, for instance, that we get here. And we had discussed that, I guess, last year. But the thing is, I was interested, you were saying that various people's estimate in the BCS region of what beta is not necessarily correct. From our numerical calculations, when we try to extract a value of beta, we don't get the values of beta that people like, what is it? Heisenberg, yeah. We don't get the same value. And it's not clear, but they seem to build into BCS correlations and what have you. So I'm not sure.
My question is,
it should, though.
If it makes sense to put beta in your resonance point.
Yes, I think one should. It's just that this is a mean field level and what have you, and then you have to worry about fluctuations and what have you, other things. Anyway, Jason.
I have one question. I think you hinted in the first session that the trap is very important. Here, you only mentioned the uniform case. What about the trap case?
Yeah.
Can you offer a few comments?
Well, for instance, this, let me see here. Yeah, this is actually the trap case, for instance. It goes up to 0.5. You can see it's very similar to the uniform gas. The main thing is the scale. And of course, as for instance, like Hank Stoof and Falco make the comment that they feel their calculation is T equals zero and that finite temperature shouldn't change the basic physics. That's true. But it'll certainly change TC. And the point is, you can't say that you compare a theory where your TC is of this order here, around 0.2, when the actual thing is in a trap, and it's in fact due to properties of trap, as you see, it goes up characteristically to 0.5, and it's a puzzle. Now, I might say in connection with the experimental papers this morning, I think there was some such suggestion by both Debbie and Wolfgang that while they talk about, in some sense, the place where their colors change and in some sense the condensate fraction disappears, then maybe their estimates of that are poor. So maybe you do get, but you should get up to around 0.5. That is universal. That's 0.5. That's BEC. That's Einstein 1925. Molecules are bosons and they should have a TC of that order. The only loophole, I agree, is if somehow you have strong depletion, which is...
We're going to have one more question here.
Yeah. Okay, so I think in the picture you present about the BCS and the BEC theory, you have hybridization between molecule and Cooper pair.
Very strong.
For arbitrary coupling, right? Yeah. If the G is... finite. For the usual BCS theory, then there's no role of this kind of hybridization. I mean, if I take a single channel.
Right.
So the question is, the first question is whether this is consistent with previous work, say, Laggett and other people.
Completely.
Okay. Yeah. The second question would be, if you do the Josephson type of experiment, the AC Josephson effect.
Yeah.
Are you going to predict two different AC Josephson frequencies?
No, I don't think so. I think you're only going to get this delta tilde. I mean, I think it's misleading to think that phi C and phi M would be separate.
But you have two condensates with different chemical
density. No, but they're so strongly coupled and hybridized, you effectively only have one. That's the whole point.
If I go to the weakly interacting limit, then it's the dominant component by Cooper pairs, and then there's a minor component by molecular condensate. They have different chemical potentials, do they?
But it's the renormalized value that counts. Yeah.
Okay. I need your transmitter there.
Is this the pointer here? How to do? I turn this way. So.
You
guys put that in the pocket. All right. Okay, is my mic on here? I wanted to discuss the excited states a bit here because I think that's where a lot of interesting physics comes. Gee, colors aren't showing up. And as a result of excited states, I think one's going to learn more about the beast in between BCS and BEC. So I'm going to be looking at both finite temperature and the ground state. And I wanted to say, just to make the advertisement I made earlier, that there's been a great deal of work post-NSR, Nozier-Schmidt-Rink, and Randerius reformulation of Nozier-Schmidt-Rink in the context of high-temperature superconductors. I don't know if there are any high-TC people here. But we put together a review article that tries to tie these two communities together, we being a wonderful co-author, Qijin Chen at Johns Hopkins, and a new, almost graduated PhD student, Yelena Stajic, who's here at the meeting. I wanted to, I think some of this will go very quickly because you've seen it before. We're starting always with, I should say, almost all of us are starting with a standard ground state. This is the BCS ground state, but we're allowing the chemical potential to be self-consistently computed as we crank up the attraction. So they're really, and the problem that I will be looking at will turn on and off these molecular bosons to answer a number of questions. Do you need one or two components and where? So if you want to turn on the molecular bosons, your ground state will consist of a bosonic component, a simple bosonic component with variational parameter lambda. All of this has also been studied in the context of high TC. The Hamiltonian that we all look at has been heard about before, so I won't go into it. Both an attractive interaction that's direct between fermions and an attractive and a Feshbach resonance that couples fermion pairs to bosons. And most people, I think Tony said this, agree on these ground states, whether you take a one or two component system. We agree on the generic family of ground states. There are exceptions. Hank Stoof has offered another ground state into the literature. And I think the work that we'll hear about from Minotti and Holland is, in effect, going toward another ground state, a ground state in which you treat more correctly the four-body processes a la Petrov. So let's turn to finite temperature, and before doing any calculations, just use intuition. It's really important to use intuition. And in that way, we'll sort of characterize the beast, the thing which people are calling the resonant superfluid, the beast in between BCS and BEC. So what do we know before we do any calculations? Well, first we know that the ground state of this particular system, this special choice ground state, is 100% condensed. That means there's only one energy gap in the ground state. The order parameter and the excitation gap are one and the same. But as you crank up the coupling, these two parameters fall apart, or as you raise temperature, I should say, these two parameters are no longer the same. So at finite temperatures, we might imagine rather high temperatures, this gap will turn on, fermions will take advantage and form bosons or bosonic-like particles well before they condense at TC. And so there'll be a discrepancy between delta and delta SC at any finite temperature. And delta SC is the superconducting order parameter, and I'll tell you how we pick it out as we go along. But this is just intuition, that we expect, when we go to superconductivity, that there will be a gap to pull fermions apart at the onset of superconductivity or superfluidity. Fermions are already bound, and we have preformed pairs at TC. Another way of saying that. The two extremes, then, of BCS and BEC, we can imagine how this gap would behave. If it's BCS, then it looks just like the order parameter. If it's BEC, then we have really well-developed pairs at TC. They don't have any temperature dependence below TC. The chemical potential, the excitation gap, or delta, this parameter delta, are all constant. So these are sort of the two extreme endpoints between BEC and BCS for the excitation gap. And they represent a very big separation between T star and TC here, and an infinitesimal separation between T star, pair formation, and the pair condensation here. Without any work, this is what we can say about this particular fully condensed ground state. We can say something about the excitations too. In the BEC regime, they'll be bosonic-like, and in the BCS regime, they'll be fermionic-like, single particles. And in between, there'll be a soup. That's a mixture of bosons and fermions. And so there'll be something in between, which we now want to characterize in more detail and even more quantitatively, this thing that is neither BCS nor BEC. How do we distinguish this thing which is not BEC? Well, we'll argue that the chemical potential should be positive. It's got a Fermi surface. How do we distinguish this thing which is not BCS? We'll argue that pairs form before they condense. Hence, there's a gap at TC, an excitation gap at TC. We call this, in high TC jargon, the pseudo-gap, because pairs form before they condense. You have to put some energy in to pull fermions apart at TC. Okay, so this is an intermediate regime, well quantifiable. And I'll show you a variety of different calculations and how we can sort of tag along the Cooper pair size and all the other components that were questioned earlier in this context of the so-called pseudogap. Just a little bit of theory, because people think that Ronderia, Noser, and Schmidt-Rink were the last word on finite temperatures out of this ground state. Let me tell you how to do finite temperatures out of the BEC limit, just to show, maybe an answer to Jason's question too, what this condensate means. In the ground state equations in the BEC limit, the two equations for delta, the gap, and the number equation sort of switch places. And the gap determines the number of pairs. The number of pairs is exactly half the number of particles. And this gap equation tells you that the number of pairs is correlated with delta. So delta is a measure of pairs. It's the measure via the energy it takes to create pairs in some sense. But the number of pairs, of course, is going to be T independent, all below TC. The number of pairs must have two components. We know this from BEC physics. There must be condensed pairs and non-condensed pairs. And because of this proportionality, there must be condensed gap, excitation gap, or gap associated with the order parameter, and non-condensed gap. We can imagine the non-condensed pairs are everything at TC, so half the number of fermions is the number of non-condensed pairs. And they're related by some Bose factor that depends on a particular value of the spectrum excitation energy. That excitation energy can be defined, and I won't go into the details, by just imposing the ground state equations at all t. So we know the excitation spectrum by imposing the ground state equations, and we can then infer what goes on even away from BEC. My last transparency of equations, and then I've got a lot of pictures. So what comes out of that looks just like BCS. The gap depends on this U effective that it was introduced by Allen. It looks just like a BCS equation. The number equation for fermions looks just like BCS. But what's different, this total gap has two pieces, an order parameter piece and something that's not condensed. Fermion pairs form before they condense in more general situation. And then, of course, the number equation has to have two pieces. And I wanted to underline one of the questions that Fei Zhu asked. The number equation is the number of fermions, the number of condensed bosons, and the number of non-condensed fermions and bosons. The condensate for the two-component system enters into the number equation. The condensate for the fermionic or Cooper pair system appears in the gap equation. So there's a kind of asymmetry in the two and one component systems. And that asymmetry goes away as soon as you get rid of condensed bosons. And that's why I think I just saw Jason give answers that we had as well on our transparencies, that if you can correct for the number of condensed bosons, it will look essentially like at zero temperature, well, at any rate, will look like a one-component system. Okay, so now just put this all on. Let me put these three regimes on the table now here and try to put them where we think the experiments are for potassium. So what happens, this is out of the original Leggett, Nozier, Schmidt-Rink story, as you crank up the attractive interaction, the chemical potential, this is just to show you the three regimes, starts out following EF, that's BCS, it pulls away from EF, we'll call that pseudo-gap, precisely when mu is equal to zero, we'll call that BEC. It's got bosonic character and there'll be a Bose condensate. Now, the scattering length, let's put that on the map here. The scattering length we fit to Debbie's experiments more or less, so minus 50, ooh, it's going fast. Minus 50 is about a Gauss, or plus and minus 50 is about a Gauss on resonance. And here's an important point. In all of these theories, except in a very extreme special case, the so-called pseudo-gap, or the chemical potential changing sign, appears on the BEC side. We're pushing it the opposite direction Stoof wants it. It's going to be on the BEC side, and I'll show you why in a minute. The pair size, people ask about that, the PG, the boundary here is where the chemical potential changes sign. The boundary here is where we get rid of our pseudo-gap. The pair size is smaller than a lattice spacing for some regime in this sort of unitary or pseudo-gap or resonant superfluid phase. And then it grows pretty quickly. By the boundary to BCS, it's certainly gotten quite a bit larger than the interatomic spacing. Behavior of TC, I want to walk you through. TC follows the BCS curve as you, now that we're going down toward resonance for a while. Then the pseudo gap is growing. You don't have many fermions around a pair because you don't have a density states of fermi at the Fermi energy. It's hurting TC and eventually hits a max about where unitary scattering is. And it's fighting because there's a gap in the fermionic spectrum. It's fighting, fighting, fighting until you go to mu equals zero. And then it's home free. It's bosons condensing. So you get a kind of competition or this hump, which actually we see in high TC all over the place, between as you follow the...
Yeah, I'm going to ask my question yeah. now and give you a minute at the end. For the experiment of the audience, how do we connect that new knot to 1 over KFA or something?
Well, so I did it. So I tried to do it. Here's KFA. This is about a minus a Gauss on Debbie's sodium. Yeah. Potassium, I'm sorry, experiment. Minus a Gauss to plus a Gauss. So that's... and this zero is... that, or this thing is close to resonance. There's a little bit of many body stuff, but zero is pretty close to resonance. And so, and this is KFA. So, but the boundary is, I put my map here so I could tell you where I have no more molecular condensate. And it's happening. I have no more molecular condensate on the BEC side. Now, why? And the answer is pretty simple. I don't have any, I have, so here I've probably got lots of panels, and it's more of an invitation for the discussion, as I know you can't see it all. But here's plotting, just as Alan did, the number of bosons in the condensate, and here's the chemical potential. So just focus on this one. As soon as the chemical potential becomes positive, I've pretty much lost the Bose condensate. All of this, though, is happening on the A positive sign. And the reason is that I really have a repulsion that's living in this many-body system compared to the two-body system associated with the Pauli principle. And so I have to have much more attractive interactions than I would have thought from the two-body physics to create a bound state of molecular bosons. So the Pauli principle is shifting this change on to the BEC side. Fermionic superfluidity, i.e. mu positive, would appear on that side for this ground state. You might find another ground state with different physics, but for this ground state. Now, I think Jason already gave this answer, but let me give it again, because I think it may pertain to the slight differences between Alan and us. If you get to very small Feshbach coupling, it was also in Eric's email, if you get to very small Feshbach coupling, then you can see the Bose condensate appearing when the chemical potential is already changed sign. And that seems to be quite small compared to the resonances that are being observed in the potassium and sodium systems. So I think that's just a duplicate of an answer that we already heard, but maybe we can talk about Alan versus us in the sense of how big the coupling constants, the Feshbach resonance were. Are there fundamental differences between the one and two channel models? I would say there are only differences in the sense of when the Bose condensate matters. And we don't have a Bose condensate in the one channel calculation, we do in the two channel. These otherwise calculations, even the pseudo gap, aren't so different. The shape of TC and so on. So overall, very little difference as long as you don't have a Bose condensate in play. And I think for most of the pseudo-gap regime, which I believe is where the unitary scattering is, you don't have a Bose condensate in play. Question about universality. Jason already said this too. But if you take this Feshbach coupling and you calculate the beta function, which is mu over EF, it surely does depend on how strong the Feshbach coupling is. Until you get to very strong coupling, which is, and this is all at unitary scattering, more appropriate to experiment. When you get where the G's are that seem to fit the resonance widths, you're quite close to the universal value, which I've plotted. It used to be red, but it's not showing here. But there is a way of seeing a sort of pseudo-universality. I'm not sure how relevant it is. If instead of calculating mu over EF, you calculate mu over EF prime, EF prime accommodates the bosonic condensate, removes it, so you just have open channel fermions in that Fermi energy, then things do look universal at T equals zero. At TC, though, there seems to be no reason for universality from our calculations whatsoever. So because there are non-condensed bosons and non-condensed fermions all playing an important role. So I would say no universality there. That answer might be different from Jason's. One thing on the collective modes, and then I stop. We looked at the collective modes in the crossover problem in the context of high-temperature superconductors several years ago, and it's a far more complicated calculation. If you ask about the speed of the Anderson-Vogel-Yubov mode as a function of temperature, speed of the velocity, because you have to put the pseudo-gap in. In other words, you have to distinguish an order parameter and excitation gap when you do Anderson-Vogel-Yubov calculations. But the characteristics of the modes, the velocity, the real and imaginary parts, aren't so different when you compare a strong coupling system, which is a solid curve, with a dashed curve. So overall, it's more complicated because there really is a preformed pair picture to be accommodated in the Anderson-Vogel-Yubov mode. But the physics is so different. And am I on schedule here?
1 minute. I waved for yellow
card.
Okay. I had some paradox on my watch here.
Oh, good. Lucky. Okay, so I can just say a couple punchlines and talk. So the pseudo-gap for the reasonable Feshbach coupling of the sodium and potassium that's been studied seems to begin on the BEC side with very little condensate weight near unitary scattering. Hello.
I'll answer your question. Sorry.
Sorry, I just can't think. It's like a cocktail party. I can't talk. For the regimes away from BEC, the one and two channel pictures don't seem very different, and I think that's where most of the experiments are, so I would tend to agree that we don't need to belabor the point of the two channel problem. And there is a kind of universality that holds at t equals 0, if property accommodated for by the bosonic condensate, but I don't see any reason for universality at TC. I'll stop there.
I have a simple question. When you write down the ground state, this BCS ground state, it looks to me like you write down a pair wave function, and then if you have n particles at t equals 0, you have n over 2 pairs.
Actually, the BCS system, you can write this wave function a little bit differently, where this is not number a fixed number, but you
Fine.
Can write it in a way that is fixed.
But my question is, does this wave function imply that I have, quote-unquote, 100% condensate,
yes,
pair condensate fraction?
It's the most naive wave function, and it's a start toward a
so
better...
It's like the naive Bose-Einstein
like
condensate wave function without any depletion.
Yes.
Just, okay.
I guess I'd like to disagree with Kathy's answer, because I think if you... It's all a matter of definition, of course, but if you... use the definition of condensate fraction, which I think would be mostly used by people in the superconducting field, then it's the technically it's the maximum eigenvalue of the two particle density matrix, which is not the same, which is not necessarily one or anywhere near one for the generalized wave function you wrote down. As I say, it's just a matter of definition, but I think it's important to keep it.
I guess what I would say, I mean, there's certainly, we can write much more elaborate wave functions, but here they're accounting for all pairs. There are no Q not equal to zero pairs at T equals zero. Is that a fair statement?
Well, yes, but that's also true in the normal state.
What?
That's also true in the normal ground state.
That's true, but there are no finite momentum pair excitations like we would normally accommodate in helium-4.
There's certainly a bunch of unpaired fermions.
In finite temperature, in the... Well, all right, you could say, but they're not finite momentum they're not finite momentum pairs.
I'm talking about the fermion. Unpaired fermion.
Not in the ground state. Everything is in the condensate. K minus K is paired all fully.
Yeah. Let me make a just
what?
Short comment about this question. I think it certainly depends on what you look at, but in solid state physics, people usually define a superfluid density to characterize the ability for a superconductor to carry supercurrent.
Mm-hmm.
And for this kind of wave function, without breaking the translation symmetry, the superfluid density is always equal to the total density of the system. And that's an indication, not exactly the answer to the question,
mm-hmm,
whether they are all condensed or not. Though, if you look at this wave function, it does have a lot of single particle and unoccupied stuff going on. But as Tony pointed out, that's another way to look at it. Look at a two-particle channel, look at, you know, maximum eigenvalue of
mm-hmm
two-particle
okay
channel.
Mm-hmm.
And that might give different answer. However, if...
I think you're confusing the audience, because we're talking about condensate here. Condensate fraction. It's very bad if you're suddenly in the discussion with superfluid density, which is quite a different concept.
Well,
it's not been mentioned.
Say, look, superfluid density is basically a measure between the total current you can have and then divided by the velocity.
The point is, no one's talked about that so far.
I'm saying different criteria.
Fraction, which in superconductors is quite small, even though the superfluid density is, as you say, 1.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it is a matter of how you define it.
Sure.
And this is more analogous to Gross-Pitievsky sort of physics.
I am puzzled by your conclusions about the absence of universality
mm-hmm
at the critical temperature. Could you comment more about this?
All right. Well, let me go back to that picture. That was so the way in which we were able to get a kind of quasi. I mean, there clearly is no universality at face value if you plot mu over versus EF as a function of the Feshbach coupling. We were able to get a kind of quasi-universality, so let me go first to t equals 0 where there's no quarrel, to get a kind of quasi-universality out by taking only those fermions in the open channel as making up the Fermi energy, so to speak. I think that's what Jason also did. And then you can see that there is an effective renormalized universality. At TC, however, you have much more complicated things going on because you have non-condensed bosons. You have non-condensed fermions, and this actually is the sum of the non-condensed fermions and the non-condensed bosons, and they all are strongly interacting, and there's no natural way to come up with a scheme. Let me finish. There's no natural way to come up with a scheme in which I sort of get this quasi-restored universality, because these are strongly interacting. Whereas in this, for the t equals zero theory, there is. So I can show you TC. I can calculate it in the presence of the pseudo gap, which is a little better level than Nozier-Schmidt ring, and you will see that TC depends on the energy scales, and everything else depends on the energy scales. And I have no way of quite getting rid of them. Does that help?
So I'm going to grab a question as the moderator here. So I'm not a player in this field, but I'm a very interested bystander and read the papers. And I have to admit that as an experimenter from the AMO field, I'm still a little unclear what universality means. There it is. I've admitted it.
You gave me that. That question came from you, right? I've answered it.
And if there is no universality,
who cares?
Who breaks it?
Well, the answer to Eric's question is very simple. Universality means that something that, well, you will work for potassium, work for cesium, work for sodium, whatnot. As long as you are at resonance, everything is dominated by the unitary scattering. So that's the simple answer to your question. Now let me now quickly. I would like to urge the audience to please remember, you will get totally confused if you don't ask the following question. Ask all the speakers whether you are in a wide resonance limit or whether you're in a whether your resonance has wide width or whether your resonance has small narrow width.
That's this G0 parameter, this right, tune. So this is precisely where universality
is. I think Alan was talking about the narrow resonance.
Yes.
And so now the question is that whether the current experiments are in the wide resonance limit and narrow resonance limit, and I think since we urge the panelists to address the questions, what do they think? What we have at the moment? Do we have a superfluid with big pair or superfluid with small pairs? I think Kathy would say. I think even Alan would say that we have. Even though we have all this theory, it seems very different. But I think if all of us, everyone agree that we are in a wide resonance, we are the wide width limit compared with the Fermi energy. Therefore, these pairs must be big pairs.
Well, the size does vary. I just showed that in an earlier transparency. So let me just finish this point here, that the experiments for potassium are around 40 here, and it's even bigger for lithium. It's even fatter. So yes, you're in that universal asymptotic regime. And I do think Alan was working more in here, giving examples more in here. But the size of the pair is a different thing. I'm sure it's not
broad or narrow, and you get the same results.
It's just a question of how much Bose condensate you have at mu equals zero. But the size of the pairs is not correlated. Jason, I didn't get to answer Jason's question. The size of the pairs is not correlated with G.
I want to ask, since I'm on the panel, I would actually add, what do they call it in Parliament, a supplementary question. A supplementary question to the chair, namely, what is universality? But my supplementary question is, who cares?
Who cares?
Like, why is it so important? You know, as far as I can see, it's just a remnant of people who used to study critical phenomena in RG. Who cares?
This has nothing to do with
universality. Give me an answer. Give me an answer.
In critical phenomena, please don't tell our contestant friend that has the same kind of universality. It's just very different. Secondly, it's just experimental facts. You can see the experiment in Christoph's experiments, in Thomas's experiments, and it's just there. You can ignore it, that's all.
Yes, I agree with you.
I think, Jason, the one point about the size of the pairs is important. This was done for the potassium resonance, but I don't think it would be so different. I guess I should ask Alan, because I don't have the numbers in front of me. For a very narrow resonance, the size of the pairs in this intermediate regime is still comparable. Back to Wolfgang's worry.
Well, actually, I would like to address a slightly different point concerning who cares. Is there One aspect where one could care perhaps about it is coherence properties, so correlations. I mean, if you just measure coherence properties, I think it, from an experimentalist point of view, it shouldn't be that difficult to just do Wolfgang's famous experiments to prepare two of those samples, let them interfere, and see what the outcome is, the interference. I mean, is there a common and generally accepted idea what should be the outcome of that? I mean, if you have pure bosonic molecules and a cloud of condensed bosonic molecules,
you're saying two different species,
give you a perfect, and not a, let's say, if it's do perfectly 100% interference contrast. Well, in the BCS regime, well, what will be the outcome, and what will be the outcome in between in the crossover region? And shouldn't there be a kind of sharper difference than the other parameters we talk about? I mean,
I see Wolfgang nodding, so maybe you understand the question better and could answer.
Okay, I understand the question. The answer turns out to be there is interference, and especially in it's actually not the same kind as the question. How
can you phrase the question again?
The question is that if I understand it correctly, whether fermions or fermi condensates interfere in any way very different from Bose condensates. Since we know in Bose condensates, when you flow it against each other in the molecular limit, they're big fringes. What would happen to those fringes when you go into the interaction region? And there is an answer, and that will be hopefully taken.
I'll give you an answer. You're absolutely nothing interesting. There's no difference.
Thank you. That's good. Maybe we'll hear from Mary Lou.
I just wanted to. To add a comment on this, because it could be that actually it could be something interesting if you make this kind of interference experiment. You should look at the interference between the phases of these order parameters, whatever they are, and in the pseudo gap regime, depending on how this pseudo gap has been formed, if it comes from amplitude fluctuations or phase fluctuations of the other parameter, you could get different answers. So this actually could be a very interesting experiment to be done.
But this pseudo gap is a very specific one that's attached to this particular ground state and not amplitude or phase fluctuations. It's the pseudo gap associated with a special kind of state.
So at this point, I think a lot of us are hungry, and I think we'll wrap up. Thanks very much. It was great.
I think we're having a nice universality of our answers, right? I think everybody's agreeing.
It looks like we're sort of coalescing.
What?
There's still some vocabulary issues that people are sort of skirting around.
I think that the 100% condensate question is confusing, but other than that, yeah. So I'm taking this.
Just a sudden.